I got this off CNN.com. It's a blood vessel. It's designed to funnel blood cells to the heart. This blood vessel was designed by God to last a lifetime. When I sit down to a healthy meal, I'm nourishing my blood vessels. I'm keeping them strong and flexible and smooth on the inside, so the blood cells can flow right on through. As I eat well, as I exercise adequately, as I live the life God designed me to live, this blood vessel stays wide open. It does its job brilliantly. But then there's my thing for McDonald's hamburgers. I know it's not fashionable these days to love McDonald's hamburgers, but I do. I have to decide every time I drive past a McDonald's whether to cave into my craving or drive on by. I sense that thousands and thousands of McDonald's hamburgers are not part of God's design for my life. Sure enough, over time, all those McDonald's hamburgers leave a deposit on the inner walls of my blood vessels, my arteries. Or maybe I have a thing for pie. I eat too much pie, and it leaves a deposit on the inner walls of my arteries. Or let's say I have a thing for heavy cream, or cigarettes, or salt, saturated fats, chocolate, yes. Each time I indulge in something my body is not designed for, that indulgence leaves a bit of a deposit somewhere in my arteries. A little cholesterol, like a bit of glue, sticks to the wall of the artery, a little buildup, a little place that might trip up a blood cell. I can't see it, I can't feel it, I don't sense what's happening to me. My blood cells are still flowing down the pipe. My heart's still getting all the blood it needs, no problem. I heard a radio interview with a cardiologist who explained why this gradual buildup process doesn't produce a gradual heart problem. Why so many people have sudden heart attacks instead of, say, gradual heart attacks. He said there's a huge difference between 80% blockage and 85% blockage. As the artery gradually narrows, blood cells have to squeeze through a smaller and smaller space. Eventually, at some point, one blood cell happens to snag on a bit of cholesterol left there by a McDonald's quarter pounder back in February, and another blood cell coming along behind it is momentarily trapped, and before it can roll around the obstacles, another blood cell bumps in from behind, and before you know it, there's a pileup. Suddenly, where the blood was flowing pretty freely a few seconds before, now there's a blood clot. Little or nothing getting through, and the clot is growing every second, and millions of blood cells crash into it from behind, and in seconds, some portion of my heart, instead of getting more or less enough blood, is getting none. No blood, no fuel, no capacity to pump. Like someone with a plastic bag tied over his head, that part of the heart just shuts down. Now, in the Bible book of James, which we're looking at in this series, the Apostle James writes to his friends about something like cholesterol buildup in my arteries, something that happens naturally and visibly, and we don't tend to take it very seriously. The subject is favoritism. Yeah, showing favoritism. He uses the example of one man coming into your meeting wearing a gold ring and fine clothes, and then a poor man in shabby clothes also comes in. And here's what James advises in James 2:1. Don't show favoritism. No, it doesn't seem all that serious, does it? Guy drives up to our church in a Ferrari. I have a certain automatic impression of him. I want to get to know the guy. I want to see if he'd like to stay. Show him to the offering plate. Take him to the donation button on our Compass website. On the other hand, if a guy trudges in here, smelling like he just walked from the bus stop at 32nd Street, I have a certain automatic impression of him, too. It's not naturally a want to get to know you response. Not naturally a what can I do for you response. If anything, it might be a keep this guy away from the offering box response, so nothing disappears. James wasn't just talking theory here. He was dealing with a common real life situation. In those days, as we've studied before, there were masters and there were slaves. And under Christianity, for the first time, masters and slaves were going to church together, worshiping together, equal before God. You could easily have a wealthy guy walk in, and the way the original text is worded, he's probably wearing a bunch of flashy jewelry, not just one gold ring. And in many cases, historians believe Slaves and peasants had no choice but to attend church in their work clothes. You could hardly blame them for having a hostess at the door asking, "Would you like to be seated in stinking or non-stinking?" In James's day, there were places of honor in the seating plan. It was something like in a fancy theater today, where you look up and you see the box seats. This is where the governor gets to sit, or some other VIP. What James is getting at is our natural inclination to assign value to wealth and a lack of value to a lack of wealth. In our culture, it may not be flashy jewelry or designer clothes. It may be what part of town you live in or the title you hold. In any case, we focus tremendous energy on acquiring possessions and obtaining a comfortable lifestyle and securing social status. And our instinctive response to someone who appears to be ahead of us in this quest is, if I can attach myself to this person, if I can get in the stream with him, maybe I can get ahead too. Maybe I can gain some of this person's pleasure or status. And what's the outcome if we do this stuff? If I show favoritism, what's the side effect? Now track with me here, because the phrase James uses to explain this is really difficult to translate. He says, if you show special attention to the man wearing fine clothes and say, "Here's a good seat for you," but say to the poor man, "You stand there," or "Sit on the floor by my feet," haven't you discriminated among yourselves? The word discriminated here is diakrino. It's not talking about discrimination the way we think of discrimination. In fact, James is not talking about wrongdoing itself, showing a special attention to the man wearing the rings and the Armani suit. He's talking about what happens as a side effect of that wrongdoing. Diakrino is about dissension, contention. It's about creating division, making two parts that were the same different, or taking something that was whole and leaving it only partial. It's a conflicted word. In one place, it's actually translated stagger. Here's what he's saying. Here's what we don't realize. By showing favoritism, we cut off part of ourselves. We separate part of ourselves. Christ has made us one body, but when I decide who's worthy and who's not, I'm dissecting my own flesh. And the word translated among is actually in. So what James is saying is, when you show favoritism to gain advantage, you're actually hurting yourself, dividing yourself. You're breaking yourself, diminishing yourself. You're flooding your spiritual bloodstream with saturated fats. You're crimping your spiritual arteries. You're not designed for this. You're just asking for a heart attack. But then James knows that his friends are probably reading his letter and saying, "Yeah, right, nice theory, James, but it's not the real world. Rich people have more to offer you than poor people do. Duh. And besides, this is not that big a deal. God isn't freaking out if I'm just a little more accommodating of a rich person than I am of a poor person. Come on." So James starts a new paragraph of his letter in verse 8. He says, in effect, "You know the old golden rule, and sure, if you do that, it's a good thing. You're designed to treat other people as equals, treat them as if they were you. But look at the flip side. What happens if you don't do the golden rule? What if you don't do unto others as you would have them do unto you? What if you sort of skip the golden rule for some people? What if you sort of temporarily forget the golden rule because someone is unpleasant or unable to be of any use to you?" He says 10 emphatic words. "You sin and are convicted by the law as lawbreakers." These were shocking words to James's friends, because they thought this favoritism thing was no big deal. And now he's calling it a sin. He's talking about being convicted. He's describing them as lawbreakers. What's this mean to us? Well, we want to believe that God's design is kind of elastic, that we can sort of live by it and we'll sort of benefit, but where we don't live by it because, frankly, we don't think certain aspects of it are that important, it won't really matter. There won't really be any consequences. That's not what God's word tells us. God's design for you won't be the same as God's design for me, but God's design for me is absolute. It's whatever He calls me to do. It's however He directs me to live. It's whatever I find in His Word that I can apply to my own life, my own walk, my own decisions. If I know something that God is calling me to do, and I don't do it, I got trouble. I'll pay some kind of price at some point, maybe an emotional price, medical price, financial price, who knows what. But I can rest assured that the reason God called me to that action was for my own benefit, because He loves me. And once I veered away from His calling, I could no longer expect that benefit. My life will be somehow diminished. There'll be some negative consequence for me to face. I'll have to face whatever it was that God was lovingly trying to spare me from facing when He called me to that action. A little bit later, James says, "Speak and act as those who are going to be judged by the law that gives freedom." He's saying God has given you a do-over, a fresh start. You have a different law to live by now. You're free. You're free from having to cling and claw for position and status and possessions and wealth and power in this world. You don't have to suck up to the rich guy. And you sure don't have the position to put down the poor guy. Looking down your nose at someone is unhealthy for your heart. It'll come back to bite you. Judgment without mercy, he says, will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. When I treat someone unfairly, unkindly, as I think of them as having less value, I will feel the weight of my own unmercifulness. It'll corrode my spirit. It'll leach cholesterol into me and gradually block the pathways to my heart. I may not sense how my system is slowing down bit by bit. I may not sense the price I'm paying for the discriminatory way I look at people and the subtly unkind ways I respond to people, but James says, beware. Day by day, conversation by conversation, you're letting stuff in that's not flowing through. It's sticking to the walls, and the day will come when I pay a much more serious price. And maybe today my arteries are only 80% blocked. I haven't taken this favoritism thing too seriously, and I don't feel too alarmed about it. Some people aren't worth my time, let's face it. If there's somebody who can advance my career at the office, for example, it only makes sense to blow off the loser in the next cubicle who wants to talk to me every single day and focus on the guy who can help me. For heaven's sakes, James, how can you be so picky? What are you, perfect? So, maybe next week, I only have 82% blockage. And there's some kind of local politician living across the street from me. And my next door neighbor is, he's a joke, really. He's a redneck truck driver or something. I don't know. A couple of times he's waved at me, but I generally pretend I don't see him. And when I see my neighbor across the street is out in his front yard, frankly, I try to make a point of going over there, striking up a conversation. Because who knows how that could come in handy at some point. And when he makes some reference to my next-door neighbor, the truck driver, I snort and make a snide comment about him, maybe mention the latest redneck joke I saw on the internet. There's a part of me, after all, wants to make sure the politician doesn't associate me with the redneck. Know what I mean? And sure, maybe there's a little flicker of conviction in my spirit about this, but I put it out of my mind. After all, I'm a Christ follower. I'm not supposed to be doing that whole guilt trip thing, am I? I mean, who knows if this is actually the Spirit of God nudging me or just some bogus random guilt impulse, like society's brainwashed me or something? So, maybe next month. I don't realize it, but I'm up to 84% blockage. And I'm online, I'm sorting the spam out of my inbox, and I find that my junk mail filter wrongly categorized a note from my old friend Nikki, who has a problem. Actually, he's asking me for my help in this email, and he says he wants to let me know about it in advance. He explains the whole thing, and then he says he's going to call me on Tuesday at 8 to talk about it. And I think, oh, brother, I think I could let this go right into my email trash bin. That's where the junk mail filter was gonna put it anyway. And I could be away from my phone on Tuesday at 8. Of course, I could email him back and tell him I don't think I can really help him in this situation, even though actually I know it's a situation where I could help him if I wanted to, but truthfully, come on, there's nothing in this for me. It's just like a lose-lose situation, to tell you the truth, so why even bother emailing him? It's just throwing good money after bad, isn't it? Isn't there something in the Bible about not throwing your pearl before swine or something? So, bang, I delete the email. And unbeknownst to me, I've just added the last little fleck of cholesterol to the lining of my spiritual arteries. I've shut out the prompting of God's Spirit just often enough. I've closed off opportunities to respond with compassion to people in need just often enough. I've told myself a self-serving story to avoid making a sacrifice just often enough that my heart isn't getting anything anymore. It's starving. It's dying. I don't realize how I got there. I don't realize what's happening. So the next Friday, they give me the news. I just got a big promotion. And I know it was because I successfully charmed the guy who could advance my career. But you know what? It doesn't taste as good as I thought it would. And the next day, my cool neighbor across the street happens to say, "Hey, you know that dope next door to you got picked up on a DUI last night. His wife threw him out. Hilarious, huh?" But it doesn't feel very funny to me now. And on Tuesday at 8, I forget to turn off my phone, and there's Nikki. I see his name and number on my caller ID, and I have this sick, sick feeling in the pit of my stomach, but I don't pick up. I decide I'll make up some story, some way to get out of it. I'm having a spiritual heart attack. I thought this favoritism thing was nothing. It was stupid. It was a waste of teaching time on a Compass DVD. But the gunk built up in my arteries. And now my heart is starving. I'm losing touch with how to love, how to be compassionate, how to express Christ's heart, how to reflect what God has given me to those around. There is a way to avoid the spiritual heart attack. James says it very plainly. Mercy triumphs over judgment. It's painfully simple. Do things differently. When you have that avoidance impulse, check it and see if God wouldn't smile if you decided to go toward that person instead of slipping away. And when you have that put-down impulse, check it and see how God smiles when you decide to slip an arm around that person, ask how they're doing. When you have that superiority impulse, check it and see how God moves through you as you become Jesus to that so-called inferior person, that person who isn't really inferior at all, that person Jesus died for just as surely as he died for you. Let me pray for you and me both. God, help us to check those impulses by the power of your Spirit working through us, lovingly reminding us, nudge us before it's too late. Help us to keep our spiritual arteries open to your prompting and to love others around us as you've loved us. Help us to experience the joy of living in the fullness of that aspect of your design for us. And I thank you, Father. Amen.
Soon.